I'm going to hand over to Simon, who's going to talk to you in a little more depth and detail about the construction process and some of the design challenges we faced.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. My name is Simon Wright. I'm Director of Venues and Infrastructure at the ODA. So this evening, I'm going to focus really on the construction delivery. I'm a civil engineer. I'm a member of the Institution of Civil Engineers. I'm a fellow of that organization. I'm proud of it. And we have been working with an awful lot of technical people, engineers, planners, to deliver this enormous project. Where did we start? Well, it seems a long time ago now. 2006, I joined the organization, and that was the time, a year after the bid was won, when things were really beginning to become quite serious. Clearly, the ODA had been in existence for a little while, and now suddenly we were confronted with the need to start really detailed design and getting into procurement and delivery. The start of the race. This is the 100 metres final in Beijing, which I was lucky enough to be at. I took that picture. I was right above the start line, and Usain Bolt ran that amazing race, got the world record, finished at a trot, really waving to the audience, and we thought, that's the race we want to run. So it was a good metaphor for how we wanted to take things forward. You need a plan when you're going to deliver a massive project like the Olympics. So we started with a very simple plan, 2-4-1. 2 years for planning, 4 years for construction, and 1 year for testing and delivery. And we're now into that last 1 year. So we set ourselves a simple timetable at the very outset, something we can communicate clearly with the rest of the organization. And we set ourselves a number of clear targets that we needed to meet. So we call these things, for instance, the big build up till summer of 2011, so that they could be easily communicated to others. We went into a very serious debate about procurement. What type of organization did we want to be, and how were we going to procure this enormous program? We decided to remain a relatively lean client, relatively few in number. Clearly, we needed to establish the baseline. What is it? What are the requirements? We developed a very significant 500-page baseline report and a budget which went with it. That budget was set in 2007, has remained intact ever since. We went out to hire ourselves a delivery partner. As a lean client, you need arms and legs. You need brain power and strength in depth. And through a European procurement process, we hired a program delivery partner called CLM, CH2M Hill, Lange, Rourke and Mace. And that organization has been partnering with us ever since 2006. And we set out a number of very clear policies that Jerome has mentioned. What is it we wanted to achieve, as well as on time, on budget? And in addition, we decided that we would accept appropriate risk. As a public body, we were not risk shy. We wanted to be able to absorb risk where it was cost effective, and where it was better value for money for the public sector to take the risk than the private sector. And very importantly, we were very clear that we would work on a collaborative basis, sharing information, being transparent and open as a public body, spending public money. It's very clear that one has to be very honest and open and transparent about what's going on, and working collaboratively with our partners. So a huge number of tenders were required. We ran it through an e-tendering system, a website. 1,500 companies have supplied directly to the ODA, and most of them are UK companies, so it's been good for the economy during a very difficult time. Half are based outside of London. That's a fact some people are not aware of. This has not been a purely London-centric project, and we've had a large number of SMEs involved. So into the works themselves. We divided the project up. Of course, you have an elephant and you've got to eat him in small chunks. So we divided the project up into a number of sub-projects or programs, sub-programs, if you like. And Enabling Works is one of the large projects that was at the outset. Jerome talked about the legacy of contamination. We had a huge site and we needed to clean it up in order to create the platform for the future development. We had a lot of Japanese knotweed, that invasive species that is difficult and expensive to get rid of. And a lot of existing utilities that were pretty much redundant and needed to be removed, rivers to clean up, flood defences to improve. And all of that had to be done when we had no design, no real design yet in absolute clarity for the future. So flexibility was very important at this early stage. We have the ubiquitous fridge mountain, and we had pylons, high-voltage overhead cables strewn the site north and south. Completely impossible to develop the site with these in place. Very difficult task to remove them. So very early project was to put them into two tunnels. We developed two underground tunnels, 12 kilometres long, and then the high-voltage cables could safely be routed through those tunnels, clearing the way for the contamination of the soil above and the future development of the venues. Demolition. One of the key targets was material reuse. So in our drive for sustainability, when we demolish a building, we don't just take it off-site and dump it in landfill. We seek ways of reusing that material. We were successful in actually reusing more than 98% of all that waste material from site. In fact, in some places, we actually demolished buildings or took buildings apart and relocated them intact elsewhere. One of them went to Tanzania as an aid agency outpost. So we had a great deal of success in reusing waste materials. As material was crushed on site, it was either stockpiled for use as engineering materials, or in some places, for instance, old granite paving was actually set aside for use in the landscape. Archaeology was enormously important. Clearly, this site has had a long history, as Jerome has mentioned. We had 140 archaeological trenches. This is one of them. Have you ever seen something as deep and as large as that as an archaeological dig? That went down some 14 metres to find a medieval roadway, which you can see there where those engineers are standing. It was then recorded, monitored, logged, photographed, and then safely buried for posterity. And in fact, it's not far from where the velodrome is today. On into the soil, the earthworks. Some huge task to map and to investigate what's there, the legacy from the industrial past, and then to find ways of treating it cost effectively. So we had something like 800,000 cubic metres of material to treat for contamination and to try and find ways of reusing it. And this soil washing technique became our preferred method. We ended up with five of these machines, the largest soil washing activity in Europe at the time, a technique that was really, I think, advanced significantly on our site. And we ended up with large amounts of reusable material. So the contaminated, crushed material is washed, shaken, sieved, and separated, and you end up with reusable sands and gravels and a fraction that is very much smaller than the total. Obviously, something like 20% only has to be removed off-site for disposal, which is the very contaminated fraction. But most of the material is then reused as fill on-site. Utilities. A very important part of our sustainability strategy was to get a highly energy-efficient and water-efficient site. We also wanted it to be cost-effective, so one of the things we put forward to government was that we would seek significant private sector investment in the utility networks. There are many ways one can do that now, and we ended up deciding that we would seek long-term concession contracts for some of the utility services. So those ended up being energy, high-voltage electrical networks, and the gas networks. So we've ended up with 40-year concessions for those components. On energy, a 40-year concession has been placed with a French company, Cofili. They provide design, build, finance, own and operate the energy centre and the distribution networks, and we provide them with a guarantee of purchase of power and electricity. So they take the development risk, and they take also the volume risk on the build-out rate. And for that, they've invested some £90 million in the capital works. A very significant sum. The community energy networks have been developed. We have two aspects to it, the Olympic Park, the Olympic Village, and then the Stratford City in yellow. And we have two energy centres in red, which are interconnected to give resilience. There's the energy centre at King's Yard on the edge of the site. That's one of those that we have developed. And you can see it now with its cladding in place and some of the chiller plant on the roof and the stack in place. And that plant is developed in phases. The building is built out in the long term, but internally we only put something like 20 megawatts of heating. In the long term, it can produce something like 120 megawatts. This is a gas-fired engine plant. It's a CCHP, combined cooling heat and power. It produces electricity, hot water, and chilled water. And it serves all of the Olympic facilities during the Games, serves the Olympic Village, the Athletes' Village, and it puts cooled, chilled water to the IBC, the International Broadcast Centre. And it's there for the long term to provide energy, low carbon, sort of very, very efficient energy for the long term development of that site, and provides a very useful contribution towards the reduction in carbon emissions of 50% overall, which has now been achieved. We have 16 kilometres of heating pipe work, 2 kilometres of cooling pipe work. This is big stuff. This is 700 mil. So we're talking about big pipes in the ground, insulated as well. So the King's Yard design, the energy centre, was in partly a new building, partly an existing building. The engine's there. And then clad, it's a large power station in the middle of the Olympic Park. It has to be designed accordingly. And so as a prominent building, we spent quite a bit of time in the architecture of this. And we've insisted that, you know, a good firm of good practice of architects was part of the original team. And we've come up with a building, I think, that stands its ground in the park. Here are the heating pipes and chilled water pipes in the ground. You have a flow and return. Highways have to be big enough to accommodate this stuff. When you've got your normal highway design with water, electricity, gas, and so on, these often have not been taken into account in terms of space in the highway. And that's something to be thought about in the longer term. The high voltage network was also on a design, build, own, and operate basis. We built a new, very resilient, high-voltage primary substation, 3 independent feeds off the grid at 132 kVA, and then stepped down to 11 kVA to serve the site. Highly resilient and very efficient system. Sewerage, a new foul sewer tunnel built from north to south, ending up in this wet well here, gravity fed to the wet well, and it's pumped up into the Basiljet foul sewer. Here's the pumping station. There is no reason why utility buildings should look ugly and boring. These pink tanks are the odour control tanks, rather comically known as Pinky and Perky. And again, a good architect cooperatively working with engineers to create an interesting building. By the way, the building is round because it sits over a round shaft, so the pumping station is founded on the wet well. Why do we build square pumping stations over round wet wells? This is, I think, the first time we built a round pumping station. And so that pumps wastewater up into the greenway, into the Basiljet foul sewer. We've clad it in concrete panels illustrated with Basiljet's drawings from 1858 as a sign of respect to our forefathers, the Victorian engineers, who built that fantastic sewer, which is still serving us very well today. I only hope that our engineering is as well built and will last as long as his did. And so, a nice building, well executed. No reason why we have to skimp on the design of utility buildings. Bridges. Jerome mentioned this is crisscrossed with roads and railways and rivers, and we had to re-stitch the place together. So 33 new bridges, some permanent, some temporary. There's no need to build for games time capacity on a permanent basis. Huge crowds in games time. There won't be those sorts of numbers in the longer term, so some of the bridges are built more cheaply on a temporary basis. Large spans, steel structures by and large, box structures, A for security, B for aesthetic reasons. Some arch spans, large spans over the Channel Tunnel rail link, and then some varying types of bridges, generally built off-site, prefabrication, lifted in one piece. In one instance, we decided to do something a bit different. So this was an architectural bridge competition one by Hennigan Peng Architects, who designed the Cairo Museum, the new museum in Egypt, based in Dublin. And this is partly temporary, partly permanent. The Z-shaped building with the gravel finish is the permanent bridge, and the coloured areas in between is all temporary for games. This aerial shot shows the span. It's quite a narrow span, but it's about 50 metres wide. But underneath is an absolutely stunning structure, clad in polished stainless steel. Absolutely amazing, reflecting the river and the surrounding structures. So that is the reflection of the stadium in this beautiful underside of this polished bridge. Very, very interesting structure. And there is the top deck. Those are, well, it was purported that those coloured circles were made out of crushed training shoes, ground up old training shoes. I'm not sure that was absolutely the case, but it was certainly ground up waste rubber. And that'll all be removed after the games, and then that bowl opened up to create an amphitheatre with a very elegant Z-shaped bridge remaining permanently. Here's a more, shall I say, sort of normal bridge that just fits quietly into the landscape, spans the rivers, and you have there the permanent span, and the temporary span can be removed after the games. Back down to the park, which Jerome mentioned, the parklands are, first of all, for ecology and wildlife, of course, also for people in the long term, and indeed, in addition, they provide flood storage. So we have online flood storage capacity in this wetland bowl, which we've cut out of the contaminated land, planted up with reeds, creates a very interesting and very sort of surprisingly quiet environment down there at the river's edge when you get down below the sort of rim level. Planted up with wildflowers, we have art on some of the bridges. Those swirl patterns are made from crushed up CDs, so we're using waste as art. Creates a bit of interest and excitement. And then, of course, we have the orbit, which OPLC and Mittal are sponsoring. Mittal is paying for. Private sector development just been topped out. The largest art feature in Britain, I think, now. So the stadium, very quickly, started in April 07. That was the existing, so that is the site with the existing buildings on it. Very rapidly getting into the development of the bowl in June 2008. Contaminated site, huge amounts of material to be excavated, pile foundations. Then into the superstructure. Probably a, you know, incredibly elegant structure, the roof and the bowl structure are separated structurally, which allowed one to proceed much more at much higher pace whilst the other was finalised in design. Its roof covers part of the upper stands. It's not entirely roofed, but it's a significant proportion is roofed with a very lightweight fabric. And then the finished structure provides this sort of very elegant, very lightweight, very low embodied carbon, 80,000 seats, possible to demount it to 25,000 seats, depending on what the legacy company wished to do in the long term. So it provides that flexibility and that long-term reuse options. And there is the stadium completed. The Mondo track is down. The grass is cut nice and neat, and it's all ready for the games to commence. And that's it in the games. The aquatics, Jerome has already mentioned, Zaha Hadid and Arup design, providing this incredible roof, larger span than Terminal 5 roof, built in various components in South Wales, very complex steelwork, jacked up onto 3 points, supported on only 3 points, and finished now, completed with its wings to provide 17,000 seats in the games time, and demounted to 3,000 long term. Basketball is a purely temporary stadium, the largest ever built, I think, 12,000 seats. Possible to relocate that intact elsewhere, possibly to Rio, if they want to use it. And I know there's been some discussion with for sports use or indeed for other types of large space use in this country. The velodrome, I think, probably many people's favourite building, certainly one of my favourite buildings, developed on a very, very tricky part of the site. It was in the north where we have deep layers of fill, recent fill from the Second World War. Perhaps we had the risk of unexploded ordnance and contaminated land at depth. So very significant foundation problems and an incredibly elegant solution for the roof. It was a cable net roof, very, very lightweight indeed, simple to build, well, not simple to build, but very easy to build because it's safely laid on the ground and then stressed up from the ring beam. It, of course, requires very little activity at height, so from that regard is safe and provides an incredibly lightweight structure and very efficient in energy, embodied energy, and provides that Pringle-shaped, exciting and dynamic roof reflecting the use within. And it sat very elegantly in the north end of the park and was the first venue to be completed in January 2011. So this year we finished the velodrome and we handed it over to the operating company, to LOCOG, and actually had some bikes whizzing around the track. A very exciting moment for many of us to see the first venue up, running, completed, and having elite athletes riding around it in a most extraordinary moment, one I think most of us will never forget. And of course, has been repeated with other venues several times since, but that first one was very special. The Athletes' Village, 17,000 bed spaces, developed now purely as a publicly funded project. Originally was to have had private investment, but the banking crisis put an end to that, so we decided to fund it on balance sheet. We now have that sale going through to take it back into private sector hands. And so a series of buildings with varying architectural features, but coming from a range of components that are very efficient to deliver a lot of off-site assembly for bathrooms and the like. And so we get to the current phase with an incredibly complex site. Over 12,000 people have worked on the park at peak. We've had an enormous logistics problem of getting men and materials on site safely. We have a big security exercise going all the time to make sure that we're not importing risk and that people who are coming and going do so with proper accreditation. And we've had an enormous exercise in ensuring that all this is done in a safe manner, which Jerome has mentioned. So we've been very proud to have been associated with this job. I think it's an absolute pleasure to come to work every day and be able to work on such an extraordinary and challenging project, which has gone very well. And we have been able to complete all the venues, as we said we would, with 1 year to go. So in July 2011, we handed over the Aquatic Centre on time and on budget. So it has been an amazing journey, and I suppose one which I suspect that we will be the culmination of many of our careers and one which we will remember for a very long time. So I think with that, I'm going to hand over to Lord Mawson, who is going to take us through into the legacy phase. Thank you very much.